Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Raise your hand if you're working overtime. Okay, now raise your hand if you're working overtime and getting paid for it. Long hours, less pay, and work emails 24/7 from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is brought to you by Gazelle.com. Gazelle buys the used iPhones, iPads, Macs, smartphones, and other gadgets from your home or office, so you can upgrade to the latest versions of your favorite gadgets. Find out what your gadget is worth at Gazelle.com. Don't just sell it, Gazelle it.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 16th of April. Glad to have you with us. The Supreme Court heard arguments today in a closely watched case over whether drug companies have to pay overtime to their sales reps. The outcome will affect the roughly 90,000 folks that visit doctors' offices every day, trying to convince them to prescribe their particular drug to patients. But the case does have implications for the rest of us as well, and it raises larger questions about the way we work now, tethered to the office by technology. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
The GlaxoSmithKline case is one of a flood of lawsuits filed by workers for overtime pay. Some complained of forced unpaid overtime, sometimes doing the work of colleagues who were laid off. Catherine Ruckelshaus is co-director of the National Employment Law Project.
They're doing cleanup or prep work or filing reports, and they're not getting paid for that.
Attorney Richard Alfred of Seyfarth Shaw represents employers in overtime lawsuits. He says filings of these cases in federal courts have shot up more than 325% over the past decade. He says just a handful of those involved employees checking their email off hours. Alfred himself is on his BlackBerry
all the time.
Alfred thought there'd be a flood of lawsuits from workers seeking overtime for checking email off hours. He says there've just been a trickle because off-duty workers are only glancing at their emails, maybe for 5 or 10 minutes. But he says the law isn't clear on when that's overtime.
So what constitutes work is still not clear.
That could change if the Supreme Court helps define overtime in the GlaxoSmithKline ruling. Mark Bayard heads the Worker Institute at Cornell. He says, 5 minutes on email off hours is no big deal, but he worries about workers who are expected to be available online all the time.
If people are expected to do the work, then they should get paid. And for a number of workers, that seems to not be the case. And I think that's an alarming trend.
He says workers should be able to unplug. He admits checking his email a couple of times an hour after he gets home from the office, but he makes himself stop after 9. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Things are heating up in the online restaurant reservation game. OpenTable has been the big cheese in that business for years. It's connected to 17,000 restaurants across North America, and it's been dishing up steadily growing profits since going public several years ago. But now, OpenTable has some competition. As Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports, the Food Network is angling for a place at the online reservation table as well.
The network that helps you cook your own food now wants to help you eat food that other people cook. Scripps Networks Interactive, which owns the Food Network, is rolling out City Eats, an online reservation system meant to rival OpenTable. OpenTable seated 89 million people in North America last year and earned $21 million.
They've got their work cut out for them.
Gary Steibel is a consumer analyst with the New England Consulting Group. He says OpenTable has a big head start and a solid business model.
They do it the way the credit card companies do.
OpenTable charges up to $700 to restaurants just to join. The restaurants pay $200 a month after that, plus a dollar for every person who reserves on the site.
It's way too expensive.
James Chin is head chef at Chin Chin Restaurant in Midtown Manhattan. He doesn't use OpenTable. And City Eats is targeting chefs like him by offering lower prices.
Oh, everything starts off with lower prices.
Jonathan Young is general manager of the Oyster Bar in New York's Grand Central Station. He says about half of his reservations come from OpenTable, and it's worth the price.
You really would have to almost keep someone totally dedicated as a reservationist, and we don't really want to do that.
Scripps faces an uphill battle, says analyst Gary Steibel, though the Food Network's strong brand will help. City Eats is up and running in Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia and expects to roll out in New York and San Francisco this year. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
And as of today, you can go into your local Walmart and turn your old DVDs and Blu-ray discs into an online movie library. Might not seem like a big deal. After all, you already own the movies. They're sitting in those little jewel cases gathering dust on the shelves in your TV room. I meant entertainment center. But now for a fee, Walmart will let you stream them to your iPad or smartphone or download them to your PC, which means you can watch Pet Sematary 2 or Friday the 13th pretty much wherever and whenever. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has the lowdown on this new download.
That was really scary. And if you don't mind me saying, if that don't work, your breath certainly will get the job done, cause
all of that Shrek video your kid pestered you to buy could be yours to stream via the internet in perpetuity for $2 from Walmart, says spokesperson Sarah Spencer.
We know that there's movies that, you know, kind of collecting dust or just sitting in people's living rooms that they can't watch on their new iPads. They can't watch on their PCs, their Macs, when they're on the go, if they're on a vacation and they've got the kids and it's raining in Orlando and you want to watch something.
Sounds scary. What's scary for Walmart, though, is people aren't buying as many new DVDs and Blu-rays. Sales are down by as much as half, says Jonathan Taplin at the USC Annenberg School.
The problem with the owning model is that people have really abandoned that. I think with the exception of the Disney film that maybe your daughter wants to watch 10 times, there's not a whole lot of evidence that people want to watch and own movies the way they want to own music content.
Taplin says people are willing to buy songs for their iTunes libraries to access later whenever they want. But consumers prefer to rent movies and TV shows and watch them just once using a rival service like Netflix. But Taplin says movie studios can make more money if you buy the digital rights, and that's why they're pushing the Walmart model. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
As expected, Jim Yong Kim was named president of the World Bank today. And on the stock market, a mixed bag. Details when we do the numbers. China moved over the weekend to let the value of its currency float against the dollar and other currencies. It's being hailed as a sign the Chinese economy can avoid a so-called hard landing. That country's phenomenal growth spurt has been slowing lately, but still, first quarter GDP growth there was over 8%. Compare that to the 3% posted by the U.S. Some economists believe it's just a matter of time before China moves ahead of the U.S. to become the world's top economy. But commentator Vijay Vaidheswaran isn't holding his breath.
Listen to some of the heated rhetoric from politicians today, and you might think that China is about to eat America's lunch because of its superior economic model and cultural values. I say nonsense. Sure, the Chinese government has launched a big new push for what it's calling indigenous innovation. It's identified a range of industries, including clean energy and next-generation internet, and it's spending tens of billions of dollars trying to create dozens of new Silicon Valleys across China. But here's the dirty little secret. The best industrial policy is no industrial policy. China's state capitalism, which directs subsidized capital through state-run banks to dinosauric state-run enterprises, actually sucks oxygen away from the country's genuinely entrepreneurial bamboo capitalists. The system starves the nimbler firms of financing, and government-anointed companies crowd the upstarts out of the marketplace. That's why American innovators should be wary of calls for a new moonshot for, say, clean energy. Innovation is, in its essence, a bottom-up process of destructive creation, a dynamic dance connecting mind and money to markets. The right role for our government is to stick to the enablers of innovation, like research funding, education, and infrastructure, not picking industrial winners and losers. In a world in which brain is prized more than brawn, the lion's share of future economic rewards will go to those able to come up with fresh thinking that actually creates value. That's why America needs to shore up its historical strengths in creativity and individual expression. In the ideas economy, standardization, harmonization, memorization will surely be trumped by creative destruction and disruptive innovation.
Vijay Vaidheswaran is a correspondent for The Economist, and he's author of the new book, Need, Speed, and Greed. Give us your thoughts. Head to marketplace.org and click on Contact. When Warren Buffett says he thinks wealthy people should pay more taxes, well, there's nothing stopping him. In fact, the Treasury Department runs a whole system for accepting gifts to Uncle Sam. And as John Dimsdale reports, people do give.
Amber Culver is an employment training counselor in Janesville, Wisconsin. She first started paying taxes back in the 1980s.
Then when the public debt got so bad, just after the Reagan presidency, that's when I was aware that people could contribute to help pay that down.
Ever since, Culver has given between $10 and $20 extra every year. She figures she's up around $300 total.
I knew that little amounts of money added up to big amounts of money, and that's just been a way of life.
Last year, people like Culver voluntarily gave more than $3 million to help shrink the debt. The Bureau of Public Debt will even accept electronic transfers from checking accounts or credit cards on the website pay.gov. Pastor Terry Motley at the United Church of Jaffrey in New Hampshire thinks it's such a good idea she's planning to make her first donation this year.
I'm thinking maybe $200, maybe more. I mean, I'll have to sit down with my church pledge, my public radio pledge, and some of the other charities that I support, but it's going to be in the basket with the rest of them.
Other taxpayers or their estates donate cash and property to help out the government every year. Last year, more than $310 million in tax-deductible gifts went to everything from the Agency for International Development to the National Park Service.
They had a good year. They heard that the United States was wanting, you know.
When Sheldon Cohen was IRS commissioner, he would read the letters from citizen donors.
It's not going to solve the budget problem.
Remember, annual federal deficits run more than $1 trillion a year, and those have added up to a $15.5 trillion public debt.
But every little bit helps. The deficit is $3 million less because there were $3 million in contributions last year.
Cohen says a little publicity from the IRS might bring in more money. Eric Toder, co-director of the Tax Policy Center, wonders about adding a line soliciting gifts on the standard tax form.
My guess is if you had that and if it were in people's faces, they probably would contribute more. Just like if there's somebody puts a collection box in a supermarket, some people tend to pay. Not enough to balance the budget, but sure there would be more contributions if that were the case.
Although Toder says contributors might find their gifts have been hijacked.
You have no idea how that dollar you give is going to be used. It's going into the government's coffers and Congress might say, oh, we have more money coming in, we can spend more. Or we can cut somebody else's taxes. It is all fungible.
Still, Amber Culver, who hopes her gifts to the government will spark a grassroots movement of like-minded citizens, sees merit in the publicity idea.
I could see the spokespeople for the Hunger Games going out and being part of the campaign.
Hey, IRS, are you listening? In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we can't rely as much as we do on cars, but we're not going to suddenly wake up one day and have the cars gone.
Downtown LA gives two wheels a try. But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street cheered higher retail sales, but was hit with some tech stock blues. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 71 points, or 0.5%, to close at 12,921. The Nasdaq slipped 22 points, 0.75%, to finish below 3,000 at 2,988. The S&P 500 was basically flat. It ended the day at 1,369. Those tech blues started with Apple. Shares fell 4.1%, the fifth straight daily decline. It's unclear if investors are just taking profits after a phenomenal run by Apple or if they are concerned about growth. Google slumped 3% as a patent battle against Oracle began in court. In Tokyo, the Nikkei surrendered 1.75%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.98%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is brought to you by Gazelle.com. gazelle.com. Gazelle buys the used gadgets from your home or office, such as iPhones, iPads, iPods, Macs, or smartphones, so you can upgrade to the latest versions. At gazelle.com, see what your used gadget is worth. Then mail it to Gazelle for free. Gazelle pays for the shipping, and you'll get paid fast. Gazelle helps you upgrade to the latest gadgets faster and gives you value for the used gadgets you replace. Find out what your used gadgets are worth at gazelle.com. Don't just sell it, gazelle it.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for March. The Federal Reserve releases monthly industrial production data. And a Senate subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Human Rights discusses ending racial profiling in America. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdal. It's been almost 2 years since the BP oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, the largest accidental oil spill in U.S. history. The explosion on the rig left 11 workers dead and sent millions of barrels of oil into Gulf waters. Scientists say it'll take years to assess the environmental damage. But meantime, deep water drilling in the Gulf is back, which raises the question, has anything really changed? Abram Lustgarten is a reporter for ProPublica and the author of a new book about what led to the Deepwater Horizon disaster. Abram, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Listen, you talked to a lot of people when you did this investigation of the BP disaster. Did BP talk to you?
BP didn't talk to me. In nearly a year of reporting, they repeatedly declined interviews. In the end, they requested that I send them questions by writing. I did. It was about 25 pages. They sent me back a one-paragraph response that essentially said that BP did not have an issue when it came to operational safety, which was the core issue I was reporting on.
So who was talking to you then? Whistleblowers, former regulators?
Yeah, both. I spent quite a bit of time with a former EPA attorney who had been charged with overseeing BP's relationship to the federal government for about 15 years at that point. I also got to know a number of BP employees, workers, particularly on Alaska's North Slope, but also former contractors who worked at the company's facilities in Texas. Together, all these people plus a few investigators who had worked inside the company had painted a portrait of how the company works on a day-to-day basis and also shared a good number of documents with me along the way.
So what in the end, after all this research and investigation, what in the end caused this environmental disaster?
Well, there's the immediate causes, and that's well-tread territory at this point. But my findings is that the engineers who were drilling this well should have known better at many of the steps along the way, and that they made a series of decisions that were against their better judgment. And really, I sought to understand why. And so I looked less at the disaster in the Gulf itself, but more at the 20 years that preceded it, trying to understand how the company operates, how its management made decisions. And what I found is a very clear pattern of emphasizing profits and speed and cost cuts ahead of safety and environmental prudence.
Can we point to anything concrete that has changed, not in BP culture, but on the regulation side or anything else that can give us hope that this won't happen again?
Well, there's some small changes that the government has made, which are improvements. There are a number of technical changes in the regulations that address some of the technical things that went wrong in the Macondo well. You also saw the division and reorganization of what was in 2010 the Minerals and Management Agency, largely to address a conflict of interest between regulating drillers in the Gulf of Mexico and collecting royalty payments. But what we haven't seen is also notable. There has been no legislative addressing of what went wrong in the Gulf of Mexico, and there's yet to be any criminal charges filed.
Bottom line, could this happen again, do you think?
Well, there's two ways to consider that question. One is that this is a risky and dangerous business, drilling for oil. And no matter how much care is taken, that risk means that there's a fairly good chance that there will be environmental consequences, a spill like this in the future. Then the second is to look at BP in particular. If the company proceeds the way that it has for the last 15 years, I think it's likely that the chain of accidents that we've seen from that company will continue. I would not be surprised to see history repeat itself again.
Abram Lustgarten is author of the new book, Run to Failure, BP and the Making of the Deepwater Horizon Disaster. Abram, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
And tune in Thursday when Alex Chadwick of the radio program Burn investigates where all that oil from the BP spill went. I got some takeout the other day. It took me 5 minutes just to get through all the packaging that contained my food. It was all boxes and wrappers and bags, and most of it was, yes, plastic, which meant another 5 minutes figuring out what was recyclable and what wasn't. But a new kind of food packaging is prepping to hit the market, and as Marketplace's Gregory Warner reports, it's a bit of an acquired taste.
I'm going to do something now that I have not done since sixth grade. All right, I'm eating a piece of Trident gum with the wrapper still on. And look, back then, as far as I knew, this was state-of-the-art in edible packaging. But here is what today's 10-year-olds can look forward to when they go into a grocery store to buy a bottle of juice.
It looks like an apple, looks like an orange and pear, but you can actually pick it up and wash it and stick a straw into it and drink the apple juice or the orange juice and the pear juice.
And then you eat the bottle. There's nothing to throw away. David Edwards is a biomedical engineer at Harvard and the inventor of edible packaging inspired by the skins of grapes. He's sort of a Willy Wonka of biologists. His newest product is ice cream in a chocolate skin that never melts, and you can wash it off in the sink before eating it, skin and all.
You got to have to wonder about how it might affect the taste.
John Kalkowski is editor of Packaging Digest magazine. He says there is a growing market for edible packaging. Think of it as a step beyond biodegradable. Except it is called packaging for a reason.
The concern that I see is how do you protect the product when it is the product?
David Edwards admits that there is a psychological barrier to getting consumers to eat the box, no matter how much you wash it first. Perhaps that's why his ice cream with the edible chocolate skin will debut this summer in Paris, a city famously allergic to germaphobes. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Say the name Los Angeles, and what comes to mind? I'm betting freeways, traffic, sprawl. Well, an event yesterday aimed to put a dent in LA's car-crazy reputation. Ciclovia brought out more than 100,000 people on bikes and their own 2 feet to explore 10 miles of Los Angeles streets. Now, closing off streets to cars, that doesn't sound like an economic strategy. But as Marketplace's Eve Tro reports, there is some value in changing how people see a city.
Ciclovia is a 10-mile block party. Families meander along on their bikes. Packs of 20-somethings look giddy, like they're doing something forbidden, playing in the street.
Whee!
Closing the streets to cars gets people to linger where they'd usually speed past. Street vendors call out, hidden by clouds of barbecue smoke. They line a strip of closed warehouses, ladling salsa and chopping meat for tacos. They're not just here for the cyclists. This block is a street food mecca every weekend. Gustavo Muniz, a lifelong Angelino, had no idea.
I'm eating tacos de barbacoa with cilantro and green chili.
He says Ciclovia does more than boost these vendors.
It helps people experience another part of the city. And it builds a trust within communities.
The police overtime, rerouted traffic, and cleanup crews for Ciclovia don't come cheap. But the event breathes new life into parts of the city. In the shadow of empty office towers, cafes are packed. Bikes parked 3 or 4 deep in front.
Downtown on the weekends is typically a ghost town.
Kabir Akhtar, a television director, came with friends.
I've seen a lot of people looking up and around like they've never been here before.
I'm
very actually surprised by the number of people I'm seeing on the streets.
Mike Lydon is visiting from New York. Along with a few thousand other urban planners, he's in L.A. for a conference. Lydon says car-free events like Ciclavia are growing fast. About 70 cities now have them.
You know, streets are really flexible. They can be used differently on the weekends than they are during the week. And this is one great example of that.
And weekends are good for getting people to try new things, like taking the subway or riding a bike. David Sloan edited the new book, Planning Los Angeles. He says bikes versus cars is not the way to think about transportation.
We can't rely as much as we do on cars, but we're not going to suddenly wake up one day and have the cars gone. So we have to figure out how do we develop better built environments for the multiple ways to get around.
Bikes can be one way to explore a neighborhood after you've parked your car, he says, or part of a daily commute. That's the idea behind a city bike share program announced at Ciclavia. 400 bicycle rental stations will soon dot Los Angeles. That'll help some neighborhoods with foot traffic, but not every business benefits.
Hi, I'm Eric Berg, and we're at Early California Antiques.
People drive from around the state to his shop, but with the street closed for Ciclavia, they won't come.
Most of this stuff, pretty much all of it, is too big to take with you if you're on a bicycle.
Well, I do see some people that have children in little carts. We could kick the kids out and put some...
this lovely vase instead.
Put this vase in there instead. I'm sure, well, maybe the child could fit in there with it.
Ciclavia does add new names to his mailing list. Maybe the cyclists will come back another time in their cars. In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And one final food note today. The chicken industry is fluffing its feathers over dark meat these days. Apparently, the lowly thigh and drumstick are now the cool kids on the culinary block, and demand for dark chicken meat in grocery stores and restaurants is way up. Seems it's partly because TV chefs have been pushing thighs and chicken legs over the once popular chicken breast. They claim dark meat is just more succulent and not that much fattier. Problem is, America's chickens have been bred to be, well, top-heavy. And as one food writer put it, they're like Mad Men's Joan on top and model Kate Moss on the bottom. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 71 points, or 0.5%, to close at 12,921. The NASDAQ fell 22 points, 0.75%, to finish below 3,000 at 2,988. And the S&P 500 was basically flat. It ended the day at 1369. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. I'm Sarah Gardner. Hope you can join us again tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.